Michael Pollan didn't love to cook. That's right, the Michael Pollan, noted food journalist, booster of organic produce, hater of convenience foods, author of the best-selling In Defense of Food, just wasn't a great whiz in the kitchen, even though he forced himself to do it now and then. But in all of his meditations about what food says about us as a culture, Pollan realized he hadn't done nearly enough thinking about the act of turning food into food, the art and science of cooking.
It's an argument from pleasure, because what surprised me most is, approached in the right spirit, cooking is not drudgery. Cooking is magic. It's alchemy.
Pollan's new book, Cooked, is an exploration of several different elemental kinds of cooking.
I discovered that there are four central transformations that all cooking can be divided into. One is fire, the most elemental. The other is water, cooking in pots. Then you've got air, which is baking. In other ways, we aerate our food, very significant. And then there's earth, and earth is really fermentation, because it's cooking without the use of heat, strictly with microbes, many of which come from the earth. And I basically apprenticed myself to a master in each of those transformations.
And there were some interesting social aspects that you learned about each of these styles of cooking. I'm thinking about boiling water. We're talking about braising.
We're talking about, soups and stews and braises, which is probably my favorite. And this is the kind of the whole vocabulary of everyday home cooking. And that's where I really take up these questions of gender and time and why we've allowed this critical human activity to get outsourced to corporations. We kind of assume that, women went back to work and there was no longer time to make a family meal. But it isn't that simple, and it's a lot more interesting. The corporations were knocking on that door for almost 100 years. And after World War II, when they had invented all these technologies for processing food and making it shelf-stable and simulating real foods with fake foods, they really pushed. And they found their opportunity with the feminist revolution beginning in the 70s. There was this really uncomfortable conversation taking place at kitchen tables all across America. Men and women were trying to renegotiate the division of labor in the household. Mm. And then the food industry recognized they had an opportunity, and they said, "Don't worry about it. We've got you covered. We'll do the cooking." And KFC even took out a billboard with a big bucket of fried chicken and the slogan, "Women's Liberation."
Really?
So I really think we need to go back and finish that difficult conversation. And I've had it, with my wife over who does what in the house, and bring men back into the kitchen and children, which I think is really, really important.
You talk about the slowness. Braising, working with water, there's a
can't
lot of time.
Yeah, you can't rush it, I know. And so many recipes I read, say, you can make this in 20 minutes. And it's, it's complete crap. You can't make it in 20 minutes. And so, I spent a lot of time on this issue of time. And I came to see it as a kind of practice, as a real effort to slow ourselves down and not fight to rush things.
But so, I mean, I have to say, though, Michael, you hear this and you think, cooking is meditative, and I know that's a good thing, and I should be more present, but I have three kids and a full-time job, and I come home, and I have got to get food on the table, and I do not have the simple luxury of being in the moment.
Well, I have to ask a couple questions.
Okay.
One is, where's your husband? And are your kids old enough to help? And are they old enough to chop an onion? And I think that's very important. I think the most important thing we can teach our kids for their long-term health and happiness is how to cook. But I would also say that some of the foods that hold themselves out to you as supremely convenient, like those microwavable single portion entrees in the supermarket, I did an experiment with those. And we had a night, we had what we call microwave night, where we all got to buy one of those, fast food in a frozen bag things mm-hmm. that they now have in the supermarket. And guess what? It took 40 minutes to get that meal on the table because the microwave is individualistic. You can only microwave one person's entree at a time. And you're not sharing. And there's something magical that happens when people eat from the same pot. The family meal is really the nursery of democracy. It's where we learn to share. It's where we learn to argue without offending. It's just too critical to let go, as we've been so blithely doing.
You also have a nice story about a Sunday afternoon when you're cooking and your teenage son is not necessarily helping, but he's just with you.
There. Well, You know, we it's funny. He loved doing his homework at the island in the middle of the kitchen. And he would work while I was cooking, and he took in the smells, and he'd come over every now and then and taste what was in the pot and offer some unsolicited seasoning advice. And it was a great time. You know, the best time to connect with a teenager is when other things are going on, when you're not trying to have a face-to-face, when you're not making eye contact, basically. And so while he was doing homework and I was cooking, we had some of our sweetest times together. And then, of course, there was the meal.
I guess that's the answer to my next question is, how has this project changed you in real ways in your everyday life?
Yeah, I definitely spend more time cooking. I just kind of make time for it. In the same way I make time for exercise or, you know, doing my email, I make time to cook. But it's also given me this way to slow down a little bit and not fight with myself, not feel divided over time. And I am present in the kitchen right now. And you know, we live in a very mediated life right now. We spend our lives in front of screens, and cooking is one of the best antidotes. And it's a democratic pleasure. All of us can do it. This is a book about transformations, and I thought it was all about transformations of nature, but in the end, it became a transformation of me, too.
The new book is called Cooked. Michael Pollan joined us from our bureau in New York. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you, Rachel.
Last year's drought devastated Midwestern farms. This spring, heavy rains arrived, but the timing is not great, as Abby Fentress Swanson reports from Columbia, Missouri.
Missouri Climate Center, this is Pat.
Climatologist Pat Ganan has been forecasting the weather in Missouri for a quarter century, so it's no surprise that his phone rang off the hook last year as the drought gripped the region. Now he's fielding calls about rain, which you can hear as it plunks down outside his office window. Ganan hangs up the phone and checks out the forecast.
Terrible.
It's like a forecast of how much precipitation they're expecting to fall over the next 7 days, and this is the 3-inch contour, which pretty much covers a lot of Wisconsin, Illinois, Southeast, you know, the Corn Belt.
In case you didn't catch that, the 3-inch contour means more rain is coming. Lots of it.
And so planting is going to be delayed big time if this verifies, according to, and we're already, you know, really wet here right now.
Yes, you heard that right. Much of the Corn Belt is having a really wet spring. Earlier this year, this moisture provided much-needed relief to one of the most brutal droughts in decades. Now farmers are hoping for a break from the rain so they can plant corn during a short window of time that will produce maximum yields.
There are other things that can limit yield, and planting date isn't necessarily even the most important one.
That's University of Missouri agronomist Brent Myers.
But it's something we have to consider, and we want to try to get the corn planted in that timely window of, say, after the first week of April to the first week of May.
That's what Missouri farmer Gary Riedel is hoping for, especially with corn still getting about $6.50 a bushel. Wearing a green baseball cap and Western-style shirt, he thrusts a hand into one of his planter's hoppers and grabs some salmon-colored corn seed he's itching to plant.
Last year, I believe I started planting on the 28th of March, and this year it may be the 28th of April, the way it's beginning to look.
Excessive heat and dryness can hurt corn pollination and stunt growth, leading to lower yields. So farmers try to plant early. The USDA says by this time last year, 26% of the country's corn crop was already planted. This year, farmers only have 4% of their corn in the ground. In one of his fields, Riedel is pointing to the reason.
See, there you can see a water puddle out in the field. We're going to have to wait till that dries up.
Planting in cold, wet soil can cause all kinds of problems for corn seedlings. But even up until January, this moisture is what farmers had been hoping for. Last year's drought led to a 13% drop in corn production, meaning tight corn stocks and increased competition for corn between ethanol plants and livestock producers. Agriculture economist Sterling Liddell says the shortfall's also hurting corn exports, which are now at a 40-year low.
A good production year would mean that there would be less competition and would improve margins, especially in the cattle industry, which has suffered the most.
Last year's drought moved Riedel to buy crop insurance for all of his 2,300 acres. 77-year-old farmer Peggy Smart also upped her coverage. Along with her family, she plants corn, soybeans, and wheat on 6,000 acres of Missouri River bottomland.
It's just crazy, you know, that one year is one way and one is another, so. And as I said, we don't have to go to Las Vegas to gamble because farming is the biggest gamble there is.
Both Smart and Riedel are hoping to minimize the risks of bad weather by trying out drought and flood-tolerant hybrid seeds this year. But first, they have to wait for the soil to dry out. For NPR News, I'm Abby Fentress-Swanson in Columbia, Missouri.
And that story came to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues.
We have a new food project at Morning Edition. It's called Cook Your Cupboard. We launched it earlier this month. We asked people to go send us photos of up to 3 food items that they had hanging around their kitchen and they weren't sure what to make with. Well, it is time for our first radio segment of Cook Your Cupboard, where we get chefs to offer their expert advice to one lucky Cook Your Cupboard submitter. Our first chef is one of this program's favorite chefs, Nigella Lawson, who joins us from the BBC in London. Good morning, Nigella.
Good morning.
Thanks again for being here.
It's always a pleasure, you know that.
I want to introduce you to the lucky person who submitted a photo from her pantry. Her name is Marcy Meisner, and she's on the line with us from her home in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Marcy, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Hi, Marcy. Hi, nice to speak to you. I'm afraid they've sold you a pup in me. I'm not actually a chef. I'm a home cook. But never mind. I'll do my best not to disappoint you.
Well, I haven't stopped smiling since I learned I'd get to talk to you. I'm so thank you for this.
And where do you do your shopping? Where are you buying these items, Marcy?
Sault Ste. Marie is a pretty small town. There's no big box stores. There's no Trader Joe or anything. We've got the farmer's market, which is wonderful. And, of course, it gears up more in the summertime.
And you have your own garden, too.
I do. It gets bigger every year.
Fantastic.
And, Marcy, what has you in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan up there on the Canadian border?
My husband's in the Border Patrol, so we moved up here 10 years ago. He's from Michigan, so we moved up to be a little closer to home. We lived for 7 years in the desert southwest in the Imperial Valley in California.
Wow. So you stay on the edges of the country.
Yeah.
That's a big change.
It really was. The winters are kind of long, so I do a lot of stuff to keep myself busy through the winter. Cooking is kind of my outlet. It's the way I keep my mind busy through the day.
It's a good outlet.
Yes, I'm the same as you. I understand exactly.
Marcy, remind me of the 3 items that you have there in your cupboard.
Apple cider vinegar, almond milk, and the dried red beans.
Okay. And Nigella, any thoughts on what Marcy can do with that eclectic mix of items?
Well, it is quite difficult. I have been trying to see if there's anything I could use all 3 of these ingredients in. I sometimes do a vegetarian chili, and I use larger red beans, but small beans would be absolutely great. Cook them really quite a long time with some garlic and onions, red bell peppers, whatever spicing you like. I tend to go for the coriander, cumin, cardamom axis.
Mm.
Add some chopped tomatoes. Now, I cook that for a long time, and I add just a tablespoonful of cocoa to give that sort of bitterness. Now, I cook it in a huge pan, and then later on, I make a cornbread topping. In other words, so you've got the complete meal. You might want a salad on the side. Now, I was wondering, normally when you make cornbread, or at least I do, I use buttermilk. You can make buttermilk out of regular milk just by having a cup of milk and adding a teaspoon of your cider vinegar, any vinegar would do, and leaving it for 5 minutes. Now, I wonder if you could use the almond milk in the same way, in which case I would not add, normally I add a teeny bit of honey to cornbread, but I wouldn't because almond milk is very sweet. And it seems to me then you could do a pretty well of a whole complete dish using your very strange and not entirely compatible trio of ingredients.
Something delicious from a strange and not entirely compatible trio. Are you taking notes, Marcy?
I am.
But otherwise, I was also thinking of a relish. Make a tangy syrup with cider vinegar and sugar and some chopped up red bell peppers. You know, soak and cook your red beans and then put them all together and jar them and leave them for a month. So you've got a relish to have with other foods.
I like the idea.
The only thing I want to say to you, Marcy, about your cider vinegar, I'm a great chutney believer, and all chutney really is produce cooked with sugar, onions, and cider. They're a very good way of using up whatever produce you get that's inexpensive and in season at the farmer's market. Cook it with some chopped onions. I like using brown sugar, but there's no reason why you can't use white sugar. Cider vinegar. And it's always useful to put some apples in because of the pectin qualities of apples means that whatever you use tends to set.
That sounds delicious. And Marcy, you do your own canning and jarring and everything, right? I mean, you could make some chutney in bulk.
I do. And I've never made chutney before. I think that would be interesting.
You know, the thing is as well, I mean, I would have thought you could make a rather delicious bean mash. I would cook them and I would mash them as if you were making hummus, say, but using your red beans. And then I would spread that on some small little bits of bread. So you've got almost like crostini, like the Italians have, or bruschetta. Yes. You would eat quite healthily and it would taste delicious. I think people often use health as an excuse for not providing good enough food. All food should be good. And all food, if it's real food, is healthy.
Yes, I agree with you completely.
Let me, Nigel, is this a strange thing we're asking you to do? Or do you as a chef often, you know, pick up little things that are hanging around and come up with something new and weird to make?
Constantly. Monday is, generally speaking, my fridge clear-out day.
Uh-huh.
I kind of feel that anything you've got left over that's maybe a bit past its best, as long as it's not actually poisonous, don't worry, everyone, I chop up, I put it in a roasting tin, and I roast everything together. And it's just makes life easier. And also, the roast vegetables, I should say, are also great because kids love it on pasta.
Nigel, I'm glad we have your endorsement for this project. This has been
well,
a lot of fun.
It's very close to my heart because that, to me, your project is what real cooking is about. It's not about going out shopping for a new recipe every time you cook. It's about opening your cupboards and opening your fridge and going from there.
Marcy, we have quite a list here from Nigel Lawson. What is at the top of your list? What did you hear that you're just going to dive into the kitchen and start making?
I like the chutneys, and I like the idea of making a relish from the beans and the vinegar.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And before we go, is Nigella still there?
I am.
My 9-year-old daughter had to go to school today. I made her go to school, but she wanted more than anything to tell you that she said hello.
Oh, will you say hello back and that you're a very cruel mother?
I will make sure they all know that. Thank you.
Making kids go to school, that's terrible.
I know. I never heard of such rot.
Marcy, thanks so much for being part of this. It's been happy cooking.
Thank you so much. This has been just so exciting.
It's been a lot of fun. Nigel Lawson, thank you again for being on Morning Edition. We love having you.
Thank you.
And our next round of Cook Your Cupboard is actually already up and running if you want to be part of it. This time we're asking for a spice that you have in your spice cabinet that you can't really figure out what to do with. If you have some garam masala or some bay leaves hanging around that you never touch, go to npr.org/cupboard, show us a photo, and you'll get advice on your spice from fellow home cookers. You might even get to come on with one of our chefs. Well, if that didn't make you hungry for breakfast, this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
Anybody who wakes up early, as we do, knows that on some level the world runs on coffee.
Coffee time. Let's listen to some jazz and rhyme and have a cup of coffee.
Okay, over the next few days, we're going to be exploring the role coffee plays in our lives. It is a morning ritual. It's a social stimulant. Some of it's been brought into our studios this morning. Our CEO, Gary Nell, is here, has already spilled some.
And as Gary knows well, when you drink a cup of coffee, you're really connected in one way or another to people all over the globe. NPR's Dan Charles gets our new series brewing.
Every Friday, a truck pulls up to the warehouse of Counterculture Coffee, a small roaster and coffee distributor in Durham, North Carolina, and it unloads a bunch of heavy burlap sacks.
You know, 10 bags from a farm in El Salvador, 20 bags from a cooperative in Burundi, you know, 2 bags of a special coffee from Guatemala.
Kim Elena Ionescu works for Counterculture Coffee. She travels the world visiting coffee farms, deciding which beans the company will buy. The best coffee, she says, comes from high altitudes, but you cannot grow it in places that freeze.
So you need that mixture of high altitude and warm climate, which makes the tropics the place to grow it.
All across Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, people grow coffee. In many tropical countries, especially poor ones, it's a pillar of the economy. Exports of green coffee beans globally are worth $15 billion a year. Some of these farms, Ionescu says, are idyllic places, high in the mountains. Taller trees often shade the coffee bushes.
And that harkens a little bit to coffee's homeland, which is Ethiopia. Southwestern Ethiopia is really lush. It's got amazingly high altitudes. It's green, misty.
But honestly, even though there are millions of small idyllic farms, they are not producing most of the world's coffee. Most coffee isn't specialty coffee. It's just coffee. big cans, instant coffee. 40% of it comes from Brazil. And the typical coffee farm in Brazil looks more like a corn farm in Iowa.
It's just, you know, coffee plants as far as the eye can see, unbroken by any kind of other tree.
When it's time for harvest in Brazil, big machines roll through and strip off the cherry-like coffee fruit with that valuable bean inside. The second biggest producer in the world is a surprise for many people. It's Vietnam.
Not a lot of people, especially not in specialty coffee, talk about Vietnam.
Vietnamese farmers grow a species of coffee tree called Robusta. It grows fast and produces a big crop, but the bean has a bitter taste. It's often used in blends, especially in Europe, but high-end coffee producers like Counterculture avoid it. They stick to another species called Arabica. So this is one big divide in the coffee business between generic industrial coffee from Vietnam or Brazil and small companies like Counterculture Coffee, or even big ones like Starbucks or Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. Those companies sell coffee that's been more carefully harvested and graded. They market coffee almost like wine, labeling where it came from and how it tastes. At Green Mountain's headquarters in Waterbury, Vermont, tasters suck in mouthfuls of fresh brew, pause to reflect, and then pronounce judgment.
Yeah, I give it an 84. Really like this. Chocolate, melon, lime, subtle peach, nice stone fruit.
Specialty coffee like this accounts for only a small part of the global coffee market, maybe 10 or 15%. Sometimes these two sides of the coffee business seem to live in different worlds. But Counterculture Coffee's Kim Elena Ionescu says they sometimes come together in surprising ways.
You know what's interesting to me is the large proportion of coffee growers that drink instant coffee. Even on some of these idyllic hillsides in Central America.
They don't drink their own top-quality coffee. They export it to people who can pay more for it, like Europeans or Americans. Lindsay Bolger, director of coffee for Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, says if you measure the amount of coffee consumed per coffee drinker, the world champions live in Scandinavia.
Depending upon which country, they're up to like 8 cups of coffee per day, per person. In the U.S., we're kind of maybe 2.5 cups of coffee.
Americans used to drink a lot more coffee, actually. Per person, we drank almost twice as much during World War II. You used to be able to divide the coffee world neatly into producers like Brazil and consumers in Western Europe and the United States. Now, Bolger says those clear lines are getting blurred.
We're seeing significant growth in consumption in regions like Southeast Asia, South Korea, Eastern Europe, India, the Gulf nations.
The coffee experience, it seems, is going global. Dan Charles, NPR News.
There's too much here to discuss in one morning, so tomorrow we will travel to Central America to meet more of the faces and places behind coffee.
In the meantime, if you want to test your coffee knowledge, we've got an online quiz up at our website, npr.org.
And let's take an audio quiz now. We have a fresh pot of pop culture brewing. See if you recognize these coffee moments from TV and the movies.
I've never been any place in my life where there was absolutely no coffee. And people are constantly trying to give you coffee. Who's having coffee? Would you like some coffee? Can I get you some coffee?
We met at Starbucks. Not at the same Starbucks, but we saw each other at different Starbucks across the street.
You did it! Congratulations! World's best cup of coffee.
Ross, listen now, you want anything to drink? Because I'm heading up there.
Yeah, I'll take a coffee. Thanks, man.
Sure. Coffee?
Huh?
Coffee? Because I'm going up there.
No, thank you. What are you doing?
Just being friendly.
You work here?
No.
Waiter.
Yeah.
That's a lot of coffee. Okay, in reverse order, that was a clip from Central Perk from the TV show Friends. Will Ferrell, very excited about coffee in the movie Elf.
A love connection from the movie Best in Show and, of course, Seinfeld.
And there's more.
Welcome to Coffee Talk with your host, Linda Richman.
I'm your guest host, Linda Richman. Now, I don't know from coffee. It gives me spilkes in my connectigazoink. And it aggravates my hiatus hernia.
The whole purpose of places like Starbucks is for people with no decision-making ability whatsoever to make 6 decisions just to buy one cup of coffee. Short, tall, light, dark, calf, decaf.
I remember what I was drinking when I met you. It was a grande espresso.
That's right, and I thought that was really sexy.
Yeah.
I was drinking cappuccinos.
I remember.
And then I went to lattes, and then now double espresso, macchiato.
Right. And I'm now a big old, you know, chai tea latte, soy milk kind of guy.
Yeah, soy, yeah.
Because of the lactose.
This liquid has taken over humanity. There are coffee machines. We have to call Mister. Coffee, anyone? Hey, that's Mr. Coffee to you.
That was Seinfeld again, also the movie Best in Show. We also heard Tom Hanks in You've Got Mail and Mike Myers in the Saturday Night Live sketch Coffee Talk. Always caffeinated. It's NPR News.